Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Paid in Full by Chelsea Cameron, narrated by Aidan Snow and Kendall Taylor. Prologue. Gentry.
Hawkins.
Callahan whispers my name with his eyes wide as we get the communication in our earbuds that we will cross the threshold into a room with two children and a female before we reach our target. The look is wide-eyed, and it's an automatic tell that he is drowning in the fear. Frogmen don't hesitate, I remind him, just as our team breaches the doorway. It gets you killed. Callahan is new to the team. Young buck, just from Buds, and on his first small unit mission. I remember my first. A drug bust on a Colombian cartel. It doesn't compare to the shit we see over here, though. The sandbox isn't some childhood fun. No, this place is dry, gritty, and leaves a bad fucking taste in your mouth. Get in, get out, and hope like fuck you don't lose a limb or end up on a plane back to the States in a wooden box. On a hustle, we file in. There are only four of us on this intel team. We each have our individual skill set we bring to the table, making up one hell of a team. Since we are SEALs, things are slightly different than the regular Navy. While most military personnel use last names, we do that, but we also earn our team name. Shifty, whose last name is Moser, is always our driver and translator. He shifts gears in our ride, and the fucker can cuss you out in 12 languages. Daniels goes by Slim because there is a slim chance any of us could kick his ass in hand-to-hand combat. Daniels is also our team leader. Callahan doesn't have a team name yet, although if I had to give him one right now, it would be Rabbit. He's bouncing around like there's a bunny for him to pounce on. They call me Rock, because I am solid, heavy to handle, and hard. My job this mission is backup and babysitter to Callahan. The powers that be consider this a simplified procedure with no additional personnel necessary. This is a quick mission to procure answers from a shark in a sea of piranhas to get the information we need on a whale. The bigger the fish, the larger the risk. Shifty translates to the Iraqi family in front of us, telling them we are here for Akram Malid. The woman wails as the kids point their fingers in gun shapes and pretend to fire at us. Hate. The air is thick with it. Stifling. These kids don't know shit about life, death, or war. All they know is a group of Americans geared up with weapons just rushed into their living room asking for their dad. Children, generally speaking, aren't born to see race, religion, sex, or hate. They are taught it. Honestly, we could be on their side and wear a red, white, and blue shirt, being an American of any kind. Their automatic little reaction would be the same, until someone told them we were friendly. That is life over here. Much like the things many Muslims in America face, it doesn't matter if they agree with what people of their religion are doing. They find themselves stereotyped. It pisses me off. America, land of the free because of the brave. I am one of the brave, but even I get disgusted by the things that happen in my home country. Just because I am in the military doesn't mean I support what goes on in Washington. I follow orders. That's my job. It's all out of my control. Just like this situation. I search the kid's eyes. What I'm looking for, I don't know. Maybe I want to see some sliver of hope we are somehow on their side, or they are searching for some trust. We're not on their side, though. Fuck no. There is nothing friendly about us and what we do. This is a mission. One we will execute regardless of the casualties. These kids should be scared. They aren't. In fact, if they had a weapon turned on us, they would use it without hesitation. Knowing this, I study them harder. That has me on high alert. The missions no one can know about, the war before the war, we do it. The United States Navy SEALs, the elite, the ones who run straight into danger and chaos, all to help people who either don't care for help, or, like tonight, to gather information to help the higher-ups sort out what we do next. Fuck yeah, it's me, badass of the badasses. Shifty spouts off in their native language that we want him, only him, and then we're out. The woman doesn't speak, just continues to cry out as if we are causing her physical pain, even though not a single one of us has touched her. The dramatics aren't typical of women in their culture. No, if we were an Iraqi official, she would simply stand to the side and allow us access without a word. This is a play, a ploy. She is warning her man to get out and trying to pull on our emotions. She should know. We don't have any. These people, they play on our weaknesses. They use any antics, including women and children, to feed their end goal. She could strip down right now with a bomb to her belly and not one of us would be fazed. What is crazy is so many people over here will strap those bombs on with the intention to hit the switch and detonate the explosives, knowing they will die. In their culture, it makes them a martyr. They think they will shake us. It doesn't. We can't be rattled. Our lives, our team, and our country depend on our ability to be ever steady. Callahan is focused on the two children as I make my advance deeper into the home. Ignoring the woman, the noises, and the smell of spices from their dinner, I move in. A man emerges from the hallway before I can get to the bedroom. He's obviously gotten his warning from her wails. I need to search him, but the area is too narrow to do so safely. "Hands up," I order, and he complies easily. Too easily. His eyes. They hold so much evil. They flash in defiance. He is playing a game. One I hope he understands he will lose. Casually, the man in front of me moves slowly out into the open room. Again, he's too calm. It's all too calm, which only makes the hair on my arm stand up. There is this flicker, this unintentional blinking he's doing that tells me this man is thinking, and thinking hard. As soon as I get him into open space securely and give the nod, Callahan will pat him down. Until then, I keep my gun trained on him. One shot, one kill. I will take him out without hesitation. This man is a leader of a terrorist cell that is growing every day. He has created a cyber world that bases him in the United States, while he resides in the safety of his own country. War-torn or not, he is safe because he chooses to be against Americans. With his cronies in place, he is like a puppet master controlling them as they meet in libraries using our own public facilities back in the States as a base to give out orders via the internet our tax dollars provide. Video conferences spoken in code have been deconstructed and their plans revealed. "This fucker is cool as a cucumber for a man who could die tonight," Slim says to all of us as the man moves into the communal space with his family. To this, Malid laughs. "You American fucks!" Shifty looks to Malid from the woman who is suddenly silent. Guess we don't need to translate his native tongue. The sweat trickles down my face, my eyes burn, but I don't dare blink. In the space of the hallway, I couldn't check him for weapons. Callahan steps forward, away from the kids, to pat down Malid. I step to the side, keeping my weapon trained on Malid. We're all prepared for him to be armed. It's a matter of when he will react. Then it happens. He moves his arm. Callahan moves back, putting himself closer to the kids and space between him and Malid. We wait. The rules of engagement, law of war, law of armed conflict, they are ingrained in our brains. Our mission was clear. Our command is to stand down unless fired upon. We cannot simply shoot this man without cause. Seconds are like hours when preparing to engage. Just like that, Malid pulls a gun from his back. "Put the weapon down," I order as I move to stand in front of the two children. Callahan moves with me, putting himself closer to the kids, and I take two steps to the left where I can grab the kids if necessary, but my gun remains steady on Malid. The woman stands silent to the side, closer to Shifty and Slim. Callahan looks to the kids and puts himself in an awkward position, as it seems he's trying to protect them from Malid. I don't have time to correct him.
"We're here to talk," Shifty says, not lowering his weapon from the woman. "Intel. We just want answers."
"It's a lie. We don't want to talk here. Our orders are to pick him up and remove him from the home. At our camp, he will get interrogated until he breaks. He won't simply return home like Shifty is willing to let him think." Malid is smart. He probably knows what he's up against. We know Malid is tied to a bigger terrorist unit, one that is planning an even bigger takedown of two American military bases. Malid's unit has targeted two government facilities that also house some essential Department of Defense personnel used in intelligence warfare. The parent cell that's over Malid, however, they plan an all-out assault on Norfolk, Virginia's naval base and Camp Lejeune, North Carolina's Marine Corps base. Both are training operations and crucial to war response for our country. While taking out Malid and his cell is important, gathering the information on who is on the inside for the base takedowns is mission critical.
"Don't we all want answers?" Malid counters. "For example, why was the sky not blue today, but rather slightly gray?"
Cocky fucker. My finger is twitching to pull the trigger, but I remain ever steady. It's what we are trained to do. Everything is about our training.
"Go with us peacefully, answer the questions, and you'll be back home tomorrow. Your woman, your kids will be safe,"
Shifty tells the man who aims the gun at my teammate.
"And what happens if I don't comply with the almighty American forces that have broken into my home?"
That's when the ugly comes out.
"We kill your woman. We kill your kids. We kill you."
Slim spouts off, knowing damn well we will do what we have to do. Slim spoke the truth, not some idle threat. This is the really hard part of my job. We do whatever is necessary to procure the information, and, like they will use their women and children as weapons against us, we will use them right back. Then, somehow, we're expected to push that shit down, swallow it all, and face our own families as if we didn't just tear apart someone else's.
"You would kill my woman?"
Malid asks with a sickening smirk. My gut churns, reading the evil in this man.
"Whatever the fuck it takes,"
Shifty says, keeping his gun trained on the woman who shows absolutely no emotion. In a flash, Malid turns the gun and fires. His wife screeches just before her blood splatters Shifty's face. The smaller of the two children cries out before his older brother squeezes his knee, silencing him.
"You have no power over me,"
Malid roars as we all react.
"Fucking kill all them."
I fire. Callahan fires. Slim fires. Shifty fires. The noise is deafening. The pops, the heat. It's sensory overload. Malid hits the floor in a thump, blood pouring out of him. A smile on his sick face.
"Don't do it,"
Slim yells as the older of the two boys pulls out a pistol from under the pillow in front of him. The boy doesn't listen. He fires. Callahan cries out when a bullet hits his leg. His gun goes off. Shifty fires, shooting the kid holding the small pistol before he can land another round in our teammate. I blink. So much blood. This little boy's blood. The same little boy that shot my brother in arms in the leg now lays lifelessly on the floor at my feet with his blood splatter saturating my fatigues. The communication links click in my ear. Shifty gives an update. We were ordered out immediately, leaving the other child in a home with three dead bodies. We give Callahan a quick check to see if he can move out. I lift him up and half carry him out. No man left behind. Before we can be rushed by any of Malid's associates, we retreat back to our base camp. Only we don't leave this mission feeling accomplished. We leave with blood on our clothes, questions in our mind, and scars on our souls. Chapter 1. Gentry. The hotel is a dive. This is typical for us. When I got out of the Navy, life was chaos. I had spent years being told where to live, what to do, when to eat, and sometimes even when to shit, shave, and shower. After a mission went bad, there was this piece of me that didn't fit anymore. I couldn't do my job. Not safely for a team, anyway. Missions had gone bad before. This wasn't the first. This one left me as the lone survivor, and that just shook me to the core. I was lost. I was broken. I was damaged. The only calm I could find was hitting the open road on my Harley. Eventually, I met up with Collector, X, Judge, and Rowdy. Together, we became our own band of brothers. The devil seemed to be calling us together. In a short time, the Devil's Due Motorcycle Club was born. We were getting some ink in Alabama from Old Dog Earl when Trapper landed his bloody body on Old Dog's doorstep. We haven't been able to shake him off since. Not that we would want to, even though sometimes he is an absolute prick to handle. Six nomads. Six nobodies with no place to call home. One road we take together. One life we live dedicated to righting the wrongs of the pasts we each left behind. My past is one they can't help me solve. Nope, the devil will not get his due with me. The United States government let me down and cost the lives of my entire SEAL team. When assigned to a team, you don't often change. You bond with these men. Of course, there are the ones like Callahan, Sean Callahan, who go out on their first mission, get injured, and get out. The life of a frogman wasn't for him, after all. I get it. But for me, it was everything. If that isn't bad enough, every politician involved sleeps comfortably at night without a second thought to the ramifications of their bad judgment. It weighs on your soul, and the reality is, less than 1% of the American population even remotely understand what you feel, what you saw, and the demons that haunt you every moment of every fucking day. I can't go a single day without thinking of the bad decisions that cost the lives of 7 of my brothers in arms. I don't sleep well at night. Not any night. It's why every morning by 0400 I am out running, chasing my demons away. Training comes in handy that way. From buds to missions, my body became a fine-tuned machine, a weapon. I can function on 4 hours of sleep or less a night. Anything over that, I feel like a zombie. Get through tonight, ride out tomorrow. There is one thing I find myself looking forward to in recent months. Tempest fucking Adams. She is dynamite in disguise. I'm the fire to light her up and watch her explode. If I'm a lucky fucker, I'll be balls deep inside Tempest Adams before dinner, Then I plan to eat that pussy for my dessert. And it will be the best fucking dessert I have tasted in my wasted, fucked up life. Damn, she gets me twisted. I look at the cheap sheets pitching a tent from my hard cock, just thinking about her. Turning to my side, I ignore the ache in my balls. Release will come within an hour of seeing her. Until then, I can hold out so that sliding in deep will be finding heaven in the midst of hell. A mix of soft heat. I'll consider it my mission. Closing my eyes, my mind drifts back to that first taste. She is fucking beautiful. Her long brown hair lays against her creamy skin as I lay over her. Tempest lifts her chin as she arches her back under me, creating more contact. Deacon, she moans as I slide my fingers through her pussy lips, feeling her throb for more contact. You are beautiful, I whisper as I pull my fingers from her body and sit back to rest on my knees. Lifting my fingers to my lips, I slide them in my mouth. Her essence hits my tongue and the taste explodes. She's a little tangy, a little salty, and a little sweet. Removing my fingers with a loud smack of my lips, I land my hand on each of her legs. Gripping behind her knees, I lift them up to bending and spread her wide in front of me. Like a starved, depraved animal, I dive in. Lapping, licking, sucking, I plunder her pussy with my mouth. The more she rocks into my face, fucking me, the harder my cock gets. I feel my pre-cum leak from the tip as she clamps her pussy muscles around my tongue and releases her juices on my face. Hell fucking yes. Waking to the noise of Trapper screaming, I jolt to an upright position. Licking my lips, I can almost taste Tempest again. Looking to the full-sized bed beside me, I see a sight we've all seen before. Trapper is face down in the bed, twisting, thrashing, and crying out as if he's in pain. Instincts always push me to want to wake him, but I know better. Last time he went through this and I woke him, the fucker came up with a knife from under his pillow and pressed it to my neck, ready to slice. No. Lesson learned. This will pass and he will go back to snoring. It takes a few moments before Trapper settles. Eventually, without waking up, he rolls from his face down position to his back where the snoring begins. Like every other night, it takes exactly 12 minutes from the time he stops screaming to when he starts to jack off. From there, only after his release when he finds himself covered in jizz, will he wake up, shower, and then pace the room. Like usual, it happens. While he showers, I have a dreamless, light sleep. At 0350, I wake to find him going back and forth like he's trying to wear a hole into the cheap-ass carpet. Blowing out a breath, I sit up and slide out of bed. "You ever gonna sleep in clothes?" Trapper asks, like he does every time we share a room together. "Skivvies are restricting. My cock likes to breathe. Move aside, fucker. I gotta hit the head and take a leak." I joke with him as I pass to the bathroom, which habit from my active duty time has me always calling it the head. "Deacon, you ever get head while in the head?" Trapper asks me from the other side of the bathroom door. He finds some smart-ass remark to tie to my military service every chance he can. It's Trapper. Mitchell Trapper Gates is a man who chases death, relishes the day he will no longer be here. Some people would say he's an adrenaline junkie. I know better. With my contacts, I sought out Trapper's past when his bloody body landed on the doorstep in front of us. We may be a bunch of badass motherfuckers, but when it comes down to it, the six of us are good men, including Trapper. I know Trapper's past. I know all about Avery, Avery's family life, and more. I don't share. If Trapper wanted everyone to know his shit, he would share it. He doesn't. Well then, I'll take it to the grave. The thing about Trapper is, we can run and not say a word. He gets lost in his own headspace as I do mine. It works. It's still dark outside when we hit the gravel. Starting out northbound, we fall in stride. I am tall as a tree, and Trapper, well, he's not. At almost 7 feet tall, I am a beast. My body build is lean muscle mass, and my demeanor is fearless, while my running partner is around 5 feet 8 inches. He is cut, built, and ready to die, which makes him dangerous in a whole different way. An hour passes while Trapper keeps up. My thighs burn from the pace. I relish the feeling. Anything that gets my blood pumping reminds me I am alive. Everyone else is dead. But I came out of the last mission breathing. I may be dead inside, but my body is still pressing on. Sweat now rolls down my face in beads, and my lungs sting with every intake of air. Yes, this is the shit I need. My dick gets hard. Press on, Frogman, I tell myself. Push harder, run faster. I roar my frustration in life while lifting my hands up and giving the middle finger to the sky, the demons and the angels alike. Fuck them all. Uh-oh, the Navy SEAL is about to break, Trapper says as he moves away from me. I'll never fucking break, I yell more to Karma, God, or whoever the hell can hear me. Trapper laughs. You need a slap on the ass or an attaboy? One day, Trapper, I'm gonna kick your ass. He then rushes over, smacks my ass, before taking off on a full-blown sprint, all while yelling out to me, Promises, promises, sailor boy! I find myself laughing out loud as I press on to catch up to the twisted fuck in front of me. This is the Devil's Due, MC. The six of us just fit together.
Chapter 2. Things I would tell my 15-year-old self, now that I'm grown. Don't settle. Donna. Tempest. My cup overflows. That's what the mug in front of me says. I swirl the tea bag while the steam rolls off the top. Before I can even take the first sip of my breakfast steep, my computer pings and pings again, 4 times over alerting me to new emails. This is Monday. I swirl my mouse on the Haven's Harbor anchor-shaped mouse pad. The monitor in front of me comes to life. Email 1, subject line. Haven's Harbor Charity 5K, details inside. Email 2, subject line. Ms. Adams feature opportunity available. Email 3, subject line. Regarding Erica's participation in the protest. I stop, forgetting to even look at the other email, and click. Ms. Adams, I am writing to you today to make you aware of Erica's participation in a protest at our school. Last week, the faculty were notified of a potential protest on a project required in 10th grade U.S. history. We took it as a rumor and not something that would actually happen. However, wanting to be diverse, we did, as a history team, come up additional option to the project to best suit the needs of the children disagreeing with the assigned task. While the majority of students understood the expectations of the project, we also know there were a few who felt the project was inappropriate and planned to boycott the project altogether. The students were informed that an alternate project could be provided should they have a moral issue with the first project. All they needed to do was ask, so we would be aware of who would be doing which assignment. You know we strive for diversity, and to make sure we meet all the needs of every student here. The majority of our student body completed their journal on the great cultural divides in history. The expectation of each student was to make a journal as a repressed person in each decade of history. The purpose in this project was to drive the students to empathize with individuals who faced adversity in our history, therefore paving the way to life as the students know it today. It has been brought to our attention that Erica was the student orchestrating the protest. We offered an optional project based on...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?